So let's get started.
Not working, Matt.
Not on.
Eat the mic.
You're wired.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. All right. Welcome, everyone, to the 30th year of Columbia Forum. I haven't had a chance to talk to Steve Forrester since he arrived, and he's here somewhere, I know. He really deserves, I think, a hand of applause for getting this started 30 years ago. Still here?
Microphone not working. I don't think your microphone's working.
Let's try now. Can you hear? Okay, good. So we've had dozens and dozens of wonderful guests over these 30 years. It's been a wonderful time, and hopefully we have 30 more yet to come. We live in a region full of fascinating people, one of whom is here to speak with us tonight. I'd like to say thanks to our sponsors. Of course, we are the Daily Astorian and Coast River Business Journal, but KMUN is here recording the proceedings tonight, Cannery Pier Hotel and Spa. Craft 3 remains supportive, and of course, Chris Holden and his wonderful crew here at the restaurant. Let's give them a round of applause, too. I should say that I'm Matt Winters. I'm the editor and publisher of the Coast River Business Journal, and of course, the glorious Chinook Observer across the river. So. I'm delighted to be here. Joining us tonight is Dr. Philip Moat. Dr. Moat is a prominent expert in climate change. I'm going to resort to reading a little bit about him, forgive me. Dr. Moat is the Oregon State University Vice Provost and the Dean of the Graduate School, so we can thank Dr. Moat and his colleagues for preparing a new generation of leaders for our region. Dr. Moat is a key leader of state, environmental, and international efforts to understand and confront climate change. He's a founding director and remains active in the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute and the NOAA-funded Climate Impacts Research Consortium for the Northwest. He's very active in the 60,000-member American Geophysical Union and is the president of Global Environmental Change, a member of the council, vice chair of the council leadership team, and a member of the board. I was looking through Dr. Moat's list of academic publications online. It's up to 122 now, so I think by the old saw of publish or perish, Dr. Moat is verging on immortality. And a fascinating list of publications that he's been involved in, including looking at the drastic declines over time in the snowpack in the West, and things like the effects of drought in other areas of the country. So when he and I were discussing how to frame this program, Dr. Moat came up with the suggestion that he address the myths of climate change and decided to limit it to the top 10, but he said that he could go on considerably from there. We all, I think, understand the importance and the dire consequences associated with climate change here at the seashore, and enjoy our huge storms, but would probably just as soon they not get any huger than they already are. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what Dr. Moat has to say. We'll have some opportunities for discussion and questions after his remarks. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Philip Moat.
Thanks, Matt. And I want to echo the thanks to Chris and his crew for a really wonderful dinner. So thank you, Chris. And those of you who just arrived, you'll have to come back to the restaurant sometime and enjoy some of their fine fare. So let's think for a minute about the word myth. It doesn't actually mean falsehood. It means a story that we tell, and it's a way of making sense of the world around us. So although a lot of what I'm talking about is, you know, things that people believe that are erroneous, I want to acknowledge that behind them is a story that people tell to make sense of the world. And, you know, honestly, I would like to believe that this is not true, that humans are not changing the planet in such fundamental ways. So I also would like to tell a story, a comforting bedtime story, if you will, that everything will turn out okay. And maybe it will. So we'll sort of explore some of the science around what humans are doing to the planet and bring it down a little bit to here at the mouth of the Columbia River. The first thing I want to touch on is global warming is a recent idea. You know, scientists are still kind of figuring this out. Well, in the 1850s, John Tyndall, an Irish physicist, did experiments that showed that there were certain gases in the atmosphere, we now call them greenhouse gases, that actually absorb infrared energy. And he understood that this would fundamentally determine the planet's temperature. He also determined that water vapor was the largest of, most important of these warming gases. Svante Arrhenius was quite a polymath. He was basically the co-founder of the field of what we now call physical chemistry. And he used the basic principles of physical chemistry to estimate the extent to which increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide would be responsible for Earth's increasing surface temperature. Now, he actually published a paper in 1896, and being Swedish, he said this idea that burning coal, which would lead to a buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, he used the word beneficent. This would be a good thing because he lived in Sweden and he wanted it to be warmer. He was a very smart guy. He was the first Swedish Nobel laureate, although there was some dirty politics involved. He developed the field of immunochemistry. He was really interested in the chemistry of the immune system. He also worked on geology, astronomy, cosmology, and astrophysics. So already in 1896, there were published peer-reviewed papers saying, if we keep burning coal, we're going to warm the planet. So not a new idea. The second myth that I want to address is, first it was cooling, now it's warming. Now, a lot of this originates with a 1975 article in Newsweek, but here's some recent quotes. Lou Dobbs, go back to the 1970s, the fear was global cooling. Rush Limbaugh, 1975 Newsweek cover story, was actually on page 64, but maybe Rush can't count between 1 and 64, was going to talk about the Ice Age, so they're confused. Sean Hannity, you go back to Time magazine, not quite the right magazine, but they were proclaiming the next ice age is coming, now it's global warming. How do you believe the same people? Yeah. And then our president won, our planet is freezing. Well, in a sense, they have a point. So if you go back to 1975, this is a graph of global temperature. The blue bars are the temperature of years that were cooler than the 20th century average, and the red bars were warmer. And so if you look back at the last 40 years at that point, 35 years, there had been no warming at all. Now, there was warming early in the 20th century, but that was a period when carbon dioxide was not building up very much. And yet in the 30 years most recently, when carbon dioxide was increasing more rapidly, there was no increase in temperature. So, you know, in a sense, they had a point. But the origin of this idea here is the story. And Scientific American did an article in 2014, how the global cooling story came to be. This author interviewed a handful of scientists, and he said, we don't understand why we're not seeing the warming that we should be seeing. Maybe it's got something to do with the other stuff that happens when we burn coal. We put sulfur particles into the atmosphere, and they're reflecting sunlight. So maybe there's a compensatory effect, and we don't actually know which one is stronger. And, you know, we're starting to understand about the ice age cycle, and maybe we're headed for an ice age, although that will take thousands of years. So the scientists were sort of saying, there's a puzzle here that we don't understand. This guy wrote an article, and it sort of took on a life of its own. It's still, you know, resurrected 40 years later. The first runs with a computer program that we now call a climate model that explored what would happen if we doubled CO2. These happened when I was still in diapers and were published in 1967. And the answer they got when they took this very crude climate model is basically a two-layer atmosphere with a non-interactive ocean. They doubled carbon dioxide. They came up with a global warming of about 3 degrees Celsius, which is still what we get today with modern climate models that have hundreds of thousands of lines of code representing not just a 30 or 50 layer atmosphere, but a fully interactive ocean, sea ice, land surface, and everything. So we really understand the problem a lot better than we did. But even in 1975, theory and modeling suggested that warming should eventually occur. The first attempt to kind of summarize the scientific point of view around climate change beyond just the individual contributions of scientific papers was the first assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. And at that point, warming had started to emerge. I'll come back a little bit later to this story about how we understand all of these dips and flat spots. The third myth is Earth is not warming. And we really don't hear this one much anymore. But a couple of the common threads in that myth were, well, it's an urban heat island effect. In other words, we've got all these thermometers around the world, and cities grow, and maybe a thermometer was in a park or next to a field, and now it's next to a Walmart parking lot. And that Walmart parking lot is absorbing sunshine and radiating heat and heating that thermometer in ways that don't represent actually the climate, but some little local effect. Well, scientists have studied that, and they've determined it's pretty small. And as I'll show in a minute, there's a lot of evidence that Earth is actually warming. The other variant of this was that from 1998 to 2010, you often heard, well, global warming has stopped. And this is the evidence that they used to say it had stopped. If you look from 1975 to 1998, you see a big increase in those red bars and no blue bars at all after 1975. But then, and 1998 was pumped way up because of an El Nino event, for reasons I won't go into. El Nino events sort of generate extra heat for the climate system. And so that led to that bump. So they would always, anybody who wanted to say warming stopped in 1998, they would start in 1998. If you started in 1999, completely different story. But anyway, so for a while there was this narrative that global warming has stopped. But of course, since then, it has resumed in a big way. So that the last 10 years, almost all have been among the 10 warmest in the planet's history, going back many millions of years. But it's not just the thermometer records that tell us. The US National Climate Assessment, which is a national version of the IPCC, had this handy simple diagram. All the white arrows are things that are increasing because of warming, and the black arrows, which have to do with ice, are things that are decreasing. I'm going to focus a little bit on the ice part because that's interesting and dramatic, and it's something where we can see visual evidence of the changes as opposed to just graphs. So let's start with glaciers in southeast Alaska. This was the Muir Glacier in 1941, and this is the same spot taken in 2004. So the glacier, it's a tidewater glacier, but it's receded all the way up the fjord and around the corner. Here's the Toboggan Glacier, similarly a glacier that goes down and calves into the fjord. This was in 1909, and this is 2004. A little closer to home, the South Cascade Glacier, which ironically is in the North Cascades. In 1928, it had this sort of hook at the bottom. And by 2000, it had receded over half its length and left behind a little meltwater pond. So those are glaciers, and if you add them up around the world, the average glacier has lost, over its entire surface area, it's lost about 30 to 40 feet of depth. So most of that loss, of course, occurs at lower elevations. Let's talk about the Arctic sea ice. This is an animation from NASA. And so this is this year, starting in March. So nice frozen Arctic with, you can see a good tongue of ice down the east coast of Greenland and all of northern Canada, Hudson Bay and everything, well frozen. Getting into spring, you start to see the Atlantic sector and the Pacific sector thinning out. And now into July, pretty dramatic decreases in ice area into August. And as we approach the typical minimum in mid-September, you see that the Eastern Passage north of Russia has opened up. The red line is the average minimum for 1981 to 2010. So really dramatic reduction. A lot of this happened since 2007. And it was much more than any scientists had predicted. So we're well on the way to an ice-free Arctic. I actually have a bet with a colleague at Columbia University about when we will first see ice extent drop below 1 million square kilometer. He was a pessimist. He bet $300 we would see that by 2020, which is only 11 months away. I'm feeling pretty confident I will win that bet, but still, it's pretty clear that we're heading for an ice-free Arctic. So the frozen world is clearly showing evidence of this warming, and it backs up what we see with the thermometers. The fourth myth is that it's natural. So, well, we're just a puny little species. How could we possibly change the composition of the atmosphere? And I remember when I was a senior in college in 1986, and I took my first atmosphere class. The professor said, and there's this thing called global warming. Humans are changing the composition of the atmosphere. The amount of carbon dioxide has risen from the natural level of 280 to, I think at that point, it was about 320 or something parts per million. And I thought, how on earth could we change the composition of the atmosphere? That sounds bogus. But it's not. So some of the variations on it's natural are, well, it's just the sun, or well, we have these ice ages, which, by the way, over 100,000-year timescales, not the decades we're talking about here. So what have we actually done to the atmosphere? This is a graph from the IPCC report from 12 years ago, 2007, but they actually have not made as beautiful a graphic since then. So I still like to show the old one, even though it's sort of dated. So the inset shows the carbon dioxide measurements going back to 1750, and the red curve at the end shows direct measurements from the volcano Mauna Loa in Hawaii, which were the first long-term measurements. All of the measurements before that were from bubbles of gas trapped in ice cores in Antarctica, just a fascinating library of old air that scientists have dug up and analyzed. And from that, we can piece together not just the last 10,000 years, but as I'll show you. Basically, global temperature. So the gray shading lines up what are called interglacial periods. So the planet's warm, and there's relatively little ice. And if you look at that bottom curve, you see it's sort of got a sawtooth shape. So we go into warm periods very rapidly, and then we slide very slowly into an ice age. And those top three curves, well, the nitrous oxide curve isn't very complete, but the methane and the carbon dioxide, you see that when the planet is warm, methane and carbon dioxide are more abundant in the atmosphere. And it's simple physics. You know, we've known that since good old John Tyndall in the 1850s. So it was not really surprising to discover that when these scientists analyzed the data. So the basic story is that over the last 700,000 years, when there's an abundance of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the planet is warmer. Now, if you look in the upper right-hand corner, and I'm sorry, those of you in the back, this is a really tiny screen, but there are three little stars there that show the values in modern times. And the blue star, they're all pretty close together, but basically the point is that all of these greenhouse gases are off the charts from the last 700,000 years. So basically, as long as there has been ice in Antarctica, there's never been as much heat-trapping gas in the atmosphere as there is today. Human race, pat yourselves on the back. We have done something that geology has been unable to do in many, many millions of years. So why does this matter? Well, 78% of the molecules of air in this room are what?
Nitrogen,
very good. And the next 21% are oxygen. Those two molecules only have two atoms each. And so that means there's only one way that those two molecules can vibrate, and that's back and forth. That's a very tight molecular bond, and it does not absorb infrared energy, which is fairly low wavelength relative to sunlight. So 99% of the molecules in the atmosphere are transparent to infrared energy. If our atmosphere only had those two, and the next 1% is mostly argon, which is a single atom, if that's all that our atmosphere consisted of, our planet would be an icy ball. It would not have any heat-trapping ability, and the average temperature would be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So thank God for that last little fraction of a percent, which is water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane. These are richer molecules with a whole lot of atoms that vibrate in a lot of interesting ways, and that's why they absorb infrared energy. So because we have these polyatomic molecules, we have an atmosphere that can keep us warm and allow life to flourish. So on the left is a simple diagram of the greenhouse effect. So sunlight passes right through all of these gases, except for ozone, which strips off the damaging ultraviolet rays. It's absorbed, that heat is absorbed by the Earth's surface, and then it's radiated as infrared energy, but that infrared energy is trapped almost entirely by those gases in the atmosphere, and that's what keeps us warm. It's the atmosphere trapping that heat. Well, guess what? If you add more of those molecules to the atmosphere, as I've just shown we're doing, then more of that heat gets radiated back to the surface. And satellites can actually measure this. There aren't any nice, simple-to-understand graphs that the satellite folks have produced, but trust me, we have measured it from space, and it's true. The greenhouse effect is real. Well, what about this issue that the sun might have played a role? We know that, for instance, the Little Ice Age in the 1600s corresponded with a time when solar activity was a minimum. Well, that may be true, but that's not responsible for recent warming. So the bottom graph shows the solar irradiance. This is actually measured through a combination of satellites and surface measurements. So there's an 11-year solar cycle. So you see the thin blue line going up and down fairly regularly. The last solar minimum was a little deeper and more longer lived. But coincidentally, at the same time, that's when the global temperatures were reaching their highest ever. So solar variability may be important over some timescales, but it does not represent at all the warming of the last 30 years, does not explain it. Scientists have used those climate models that I mentioned earlier, and they've done an experiment replicating the 20th century temperature record, which is shown in black, using the information about what actually happened with solar variability and volcanic eruptions. So the green curve shows those natural factors only. So simulated global temperature, complicated climate model with atmosphere, ocean, sea ice, all that stuff. And so now there's that warming that we talked about earlier in the first half of the century from about 1910 to about 1940. The climate models partly explain that as recovery from a big volcanic eruption in about 1902, which you can see is that dip in the both the blue and the green curve. And then maybe something funny happening in the 1940s that the climate model isn't quite capturing. So that upward warming trend is a little bit bigger. But the really interesting stuff happens at the end of the record, where you see some big dips in the green curve. Those are more big volcanic eruptions. Mount Agung in 1964, El Chichon in 1982, and then Mount Pinatubo in 1991. So those big tropical volcanic eruptions produce enough ash, put it in the stratosphere, it stays there for a couple years, reflects sunlight, cools the planet until that ash is cycled out, and then the temperature recovers. So you can see those dips in the observed record as well, but notably, the green curve does not match reality after about 1970. Only when you include the human factors, the greenhouse gases, do you get that increase, and then it matches extraordinarily well. So that blue curve, where the climate models are given the correct information, can reproduce the observed warming. So a few points here. First, there wasn't a big human influence on climate before about 1970. Second, climate models can do extremely well at simulating the global temperature record if given the correct information. And third, there's a big difference between the human influence and the natural influences, and together they can explain most of what we saw in the 20th century record. This gets to what scientists call attribution, that is, what can we say about the factors responsible for the temperature record? So if we go back to the very first IPCC report in 1990, the statement there was, warming is broadly consistent with predictions of climate models, but is of the same magnitude as natural climate variability. In other words, we really can't determine yet what's happened. In 1996, they said, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate, which some scientists call the triple squishy. So balance of evidence, discernible, suggests, very cautious words, but starting to emerge. By the 2001 third assessment report, there is new and stronger evidence that most of the warming observed over the last 50 years is attributable to human activities. Fourth assessment report, most of the observed increase in global average temperatures since the mid-20th century is likely due to the observed increases in greenhouse gas concentrations. And then the most recent assessment report in 2013, human influence has been detected in many aspects of the climate system, so not just the temperature record, but the sea ice and so forth. It is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. So who's doing it? The humans, yes. It is not natural. There is no scientific basis anymore to say that this warming has any natural cause. Fifth myth, scientists are divided. Anybody heard of the Oregon Petition Project, that brainchild of Art Robinson in 1997, which still lives on today? Back in 1997, the US Senate was considering whether to participate in a global agreement that eventually became known as the Kyoto Protocol. And they voted almost unanimously not to participate in an international agreement that did not include China, which at the time was seen as a rising emitter of gases. During that time, Art Robinson of the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, which is run out of a large Quonset hut in Cave Junction, Oregon, circulated a petition stating there's no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide will in the foreseeable future cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere. And this was mailed. Remember, this was early days of the internet, so they actually mailed this out to thousands and thousands of people. And all you had to do was sign this postcard and check a box saying that you were a scientist. So some wag got hold of some of these, and in the list that was on their website, you could find all of the characters of MASH, which was just to prove the point that you didn't have to, there was no checking that these people were actually scientists. So anyway, this was the beginning of this effort, well-funded by the fossil fuel industry, to try to convey to the public the idea that scientists were still kind of figuring out this global warming thing. Over the last 10 years, though, there's been six different papers that have done a meta-analysis of scientific papers and have found that on average, depending on analysis approaches, 97% of papers having to do with climate change agree that humans are the cause. And one of the papers actually surveyed 3,146 earth scientists and compared their views with those of the general public and also segmented them based on how knowledgeable they were about climate science and whether they were active publishing scientists or in scientific roles that didn't require publishing. So the general public, if you look at the bar on the far left, 57% of the general public in 2009 agreed that humans were a contributing factor in changing the average global temperatures. And 38% said, no, humans are not. Of Earth scientists who were not publishing and were not climatologists, that fraction was 77% said yes, and about 10% said no. Those with some climate training, or climatologists, 88% said yes, and a tiny fraction said no. If you look at just Earth scientists who were actively publishing, it was about the same. But if you look at climatologists who are active publishers on climate change, and that would include me, it's 97%. So the closer you are to the evidence and to the work that all of the scientific community is doing, the clearer it is that humans are responsible. Here's another of my favorite myths. Hey, it's cold this week. This proves there's no global warming. And how many of you remember James Inhofe bringing a snowball onto the floor of the US Senate? Yes. Somehow the existence of ice on Earth proves that the Earth is not warming. I debated about how to address this, but here's another graph. This is Oregon's average temperature. You see a lot of bumps and wiggles. Since 1993, we've only had one year whose temperature was below the 20th century average. So that horizontal line is the 20th century average. And the excursions from the coldest year in the 19-teens to the warmest year, which was 2015, is a little over 6 degrees Fahrenheit. So a lot of variation is bigger than that global temperature graph I showed you. So in 2012, which was that most recent cold year, we had snow in the Willamette Valley and it was very interesting. But that's only an average year by the standards of the 20th century. So any fans of Lake Wobegon out here where all the men are good looking, the women are something, and the children are above average. All the children above average, right? So we're in a world now where all the years are above average. They're warmer than average. Let's look at the future. David Horsey, a wonderful political cartoonist from the now defunct Seattle Post-Intelligencer, had this cartoon about 15 years ago. Scientists there trying to stop this massive truck. There's a dead end up there and a really deep divide, and the truck driver says it's a hoax, dead ends don't exist. So climate scientists are trying to understand and predict the future, and one of the myths about the future is that climate change will be benign. A colleague of mine at University of Idaho, John Abbotsoglou, and his partner in crime, Park Williams, looked at weather data for the period 1985 to 2015 and calculated a measure of susceptibility to wildfire, and then went back and recalculated subtracting the warming trend. So in other words, pretending that climate change hadn't happened over the last 50 years. And so on the left is the amount of area burned, almost 5 million hectares, which multiply by 2.5, so are about 10.5 million acres in the western U.S. That's how much would have burned without the warming. And on the right, the red curve with the warming, about double that. So in other words, we're seeing all these fires, and they are clearly linked empirically to the warming climate. It's not that fires have never existed, but they are bigger. Just this morning, as you probably know, a large chunk of California is without power because, having been sued for billions of dollars, PG&E is playing it safe by shutting off power to all the people in those orange areas, which are basically all of the forested areas below about 4,000 feet, which are at high risk of fires. So we can't pretend that climate change is going to be entirely benign, because we're seeing the ravages of fire. Looking into the future, there are sort of two really divergent scenarios of how future climate could play out. And the IPCC has generated a number of different scenarios of the future, and they're distinguished by numbers after the letters RCP, which stands for Representative Concentration Pathway. You can now forget that abbreviation entirely. It just talks about the amount of CO2 in the future. So the blue curve is a scenario where humans strongly limit greenhouse gas emissions over the next couple of decades to the point where carbon dioxide actually stabilizes in the atmosphere, and that allows temperatures to stabilize at a temperature change of a little more than 2 degrees Celsius relative to the late 19th century average. The red curve is basically an unrestrained emissions curve known as RCP 8.5, where emissions increase, concentrations increase, and temperatures increase. So you see, not only is it several times warmer at the end of the century, but it's also showing no signs of slowing. So if you want a sort of visual representation of that, think about everybody in China driving a stretch Hummer. That's RCP 8.5. By the way, I was thinking yesterday about the way we name SUVs and large trucks. Tundra, Yukon, Tahoe, Denali, Terrain, Sequoia, Colorado, Sierra, Frontier. Tough sounding things, but another way to look at it is places that we're ruining by driving these things and pumping all these gases into the atmosphere. But my favorites are the ones that explicitly talk about disaster. So you have the Nissan Armada, and my very favorite, the Chevy Avalanche. Okay, so that's the RCP 8.5 world. This is the RCP 2.6 world. Heavy reliance on renewable energy, very energy efficient economy, low carbon, transitioning to nearly no carbon. Well, these are two very different worlds looking into the future, a lot of warming versus stable climate. And that also translates into things that matter here on the ocean. So as you may know, carbon dioxide dissolves in seawater, and it actually changes the acidity or the pH of the ocean water. And that can be particularly acute in coastal areas where there are shellfish, which are affected. So this is a projection into the future of the ocean pH globally for those same two scenarios. So for RCP 2.6, the blue curve, you can see a little bit of a further reduction in pH, and then stabilizing at a pH value of about 8. But that high emission scenario, 8.5, large continued decreases in the ocean pH to 7.7. And we know from lab experiments that these levels of acidity are devastating for different kinds of shellfish. It interrupts their gestation and the maturity, makes them more susceptible to disease, and there's significant mortality. Commercial shellfish growers in Oregon and Washington are significantly concerned that they've been taking measures to offset the changing ocean chemistry in the waters that they rely on. Other concerns about climate change not being entirely benign. This was from a paper a few years ago that looked back at the history of the Antarctic ice sheet and tested it with a model. And first of all, they observe that these ice shelves are areas where the ice is rapidly flowing out into the sea. But the surrounding areas, so the colors indicate the rate of ice flow. There's some surrounding areas around the Ross ice shelf that are accelerating the flow of ice to the sea as well. And you can see some light blue colors all the way around the edges. So we used to think that the big story with Antarctica was that a warmer atmosphere would carry more moisture onto the ice sheet and then drop it as snow, and that we would actually accumulate ice on Antarctica. But now we know that the main story is actually that the edges of Antarctica are flowing into the sea much faster. So DeCanto and Pollard, these authors, spun this forward 500 years. And here is where you start to see a really huge difference between the low emissions to stabilizing scenario, RCP 2.6, which is the basically flat black curve, and the high emission scenario 8.5. The y-axis here is in meters. So the top of that graph, the red curve, is 13 meters. That's over 40 feet of sea level rise. Now, we are talking about the year 2500, so none of us will be here. But, you know, we've built towns and cities and railroads and so forth where they are, and they tend to stay where they are until something destroys them. So this, you know, the choices that we make in this generation about whether to follow RCP 2.6 or RCP 8.5 will have lasting consequences. Now, maybe we'll be able to adapt and, you know, new tourist opportunities, right? It will be warmer after all. But the New York Times did an interesting geographic exercise. Let's just suppose that all of this West Antarctic ice sheet over on the left, which is thought to be a little bit unstable, let's suppose that all of Greenland melts and all of the West Antarctic ice sheet also melts. This would take many, many thousands of years, but when it was done, this is what Florida would look like on the right. It would be a few islands up in North Florida. But even Oregon, Salem would be a deep water port. And I'm sorry, Astoria, but things would not look too good here. There is high ground onto which you could relocate over these several thousand years. Myth number 7, we can stop it quickly. We decide we don't like this, we can just put the brakes on. Well, the climate system is a little bit like a supertanker. You know, we put these carbon dioxide molecules into the atmosphere, they stay for 100 years. Nature is very slow to remove the excess. Another way to express this is my favorite diagram from the 2013 IPCC report. On the x-axis is the total CO2 emissions over human history. On the y-axis is the temperature change. And it's a little hard to see, but there is a series of black circles that represent the 10-year averages of those two quantities. So from 1880, which is the left-hand edge, to about 1980, those dots barely move. There's only a little bit of CO2 emissions, very gradual increase in the CO2 concentrations, and about half a degree Celsius of warming. But from 1980 to 2010, those dots start jumping. So this is basically the supertanker accelerating. And as fast as it has accelerated over the last 30 years in both the rate of emissions and in the rate of warming, that's how difficult it would be to decelerate, except that we have a growing human population, a more affluent human population, and much greater reliance on fossil fuels for energy. So not only is that supertanker accelerating, but its accelerator works better than the brakes. The RCP 2.6 scenario, which would stabilize climate, are the future, represented in the future by the dark blue circles. And you can see they sort of grind to a halt around 2050. So essentially, we've finished emitting carbon dioxide by 2050, and the temperature stabilizes at 2 degrees Celsius. This is the scenario on which the Paris Accord, which you may have heard about, was built, and you'll be hearing a lot in a couple of weeks from Santiago, Chile, which is the next conference of the parties, where they're doing the annual negotiation about international agreements. RCP 2.6 would be extraordinarily difficult to achieve, so let's say that that dark blue curve is difficult to achieve. The light blue curve is the next one up. That's RCP 4.5. That would be ceasing emissions a few decades later, and that would get us to about a 2.5 degree total warming. That red curve at the top, that's RCP 8.5. That's basically, we don't try to stop it. And it just takes off, and you can see those red dots pretty well spaced out. Every decade, we've emitted a lot more CO2, and by the end of the century, we're at about 5 degrees Celsius or 9 degrees Fahrenheit of global warming. Well, what are we to do? Pearls before swine has a helpful suggestion. I've developed a new theorem, two worries make a non-worry. What does that mean? Well, for example, you can worry about how much money you'll have in life, or you can worry about global warming, but you can't worry about both, because soon global warming will end all life. Pig says, woohoo. Oh, how comforting. Coal-burning barbecue at my house. So what about the future? Another myth is that we only have 11 years to fix this. There's something magical about 2030, and then we fall off the cliff. Even the UN has said this, and many Democratic candidates for president have repeated this. We only have 10, 11, 12 years to fix this, to prevent irreversible damage from climate change. Well, I refer you back to this diagram. At whatever point we stabilize CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, in other words, at whatever point we're done emitting CO2, that's roughly where the temperature will stop. There's nothing particularly magical about 2 degrees Celsius. There is certainly more impact from 2 degrees Celsius than 1.5, and there's more at 2.5 than 2, but we don't understand the climate system well enough to say there's some cliff that we're gonna fall off if the global temperature hits 2 degrees. There's no tipping point. There are certainly surprises, and the faster we make the climate warm, the faster we will initiate those surprises. Just to reinforce the scale of the challenge, this is Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. In blue are the actual emissions from 1990 to 2013. And the good news is that our emissions as a state peaked in 1997. We were among the first states in the country to peak that early. And so we've actually decreased our emissions from 72 million metric tons of carbon dioxide to 60, even as our population and economy have grown substantially. Oregon was also one of the first states to adopt emissions reduction goals, which are illustrated by that gold curve that trends rapidly downward. The red curve is basically what we think will happen based on current trends, and that is that we will stay flat at about 60, and then that in 2030 there's a state law that says we're going to stop buying out-of-state coal-fired electricity, which will knock about 5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. So there's a huge gap from where we're headed absent policy and where we think we want to go in order to stabilize global climate. And this is one of the most out in front states in the union, California and a couple others being ahead of us. So actually stabilizing will be a huge challenge. Myth number nine, the Northwest will see little effect from warming. Well, depends how much warming. So the top graph shows our observed temperature in the squiggly black line. It's warmed a little bit, just like the global average. And then our old friend, RCP 8.5, is the high scenario. For a lot of our work at the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, we used RCP 4.5, the next higher scenario. And so that stabilizes a little later with a total warming of about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is still better than the 9 that we get from 8.5. The bottom graph is precipitation. So drought, if it happens, will only become more frequent because of temperature effects, not directly, we think, because of precipitation, which you can see is pretty flat with both of the future scenarios as well as in the past. But to illustrate how drought can originate just from temperature, Nature provided this great illustration from 2015. It was a winter with roughly normal precipitation in Oregon and Washington, but it was about 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. And all of the black dots show locations that set a record low for their April 1st snowpack. 80% of locations in the western U.S. set a record low because of warmth. So we have what's called a snow drought, a drought where we don't have enough moisture stored in snowpack on the ground simply because it's warm. And so that is not in our immediate future, but in the distant future, that will become pretty normal. And what that will do to the flow on the Columbia River is shift the hydrograph. This is not here at Astoria, but up at Bonneville. The black curve is the hydrograph for the late 20th century, and this is natural flow, so pretending that there are no dams there, which is a helpful starting point to think about the system. So naturally, the Columbia River has lowest flows in the winter, and then as the snow starts to melt up in the mountains, the flow rises to a peak in June and then decreases in the summer. Our estimates are that for the two scenarios, 4.5 and 8.5, that peak flow will shift about a month earlier. And importantly, we'd also see big increases in the flow in the winter. So you see that graph tending up above the historical throughout the winter and early spring, and then significantly lower in the summer. This will run counter to a lot of the demands for irrigation and so forth. Back to that point about fire, we're even seeing fires in very wet areas like the Columbia River Gorge in 2017. The Eagle Creek fire burned more than 48,000 acres, and it almost reached the Bull Run watershed, which provides the vast majority of water for the Portland metro area. And that would have been really difficult for them to handle if that had entered the watershed and fouled their water. So certainly climate change is not all fun and games here in the Northwest. And looking on the coast, rising seas and increasing storminess are already wreaking havoc with many of the coastal areas. Peter Ruggiero at OSU has done a series of projects on the coast with communities, including Tillamook, and really looking at policy scenarios. This is an analysis of infrastructure at risk from 4 feet of sea level rise, or specifically a high water event that was featured in our climate assessment report 2 years ago, county by county. And I'm sorry to say that Clatsop County is number one in all categories. Number of people affected, number of homes, number of miles of roadway, number of sewage treatment plants. And so, you know, even 4 feet of sea level rise or high water event can really have big impacts. Myth number 10, we'll have time to adapt. Well, you know, it takes time to change policies. It takes time to build things. This is, again, Peter Ruggiero's work. They worked with the counties of Tillamook and Grays Harbor, and they now have other projects. And the colored squares there indicate different climate scenarios and also different policy scenarios devised by the communities. And you know, some of these things are hugely expensive. So the PROTECT scenario is sort of tens of millions of dollars to protect shorelines. But if you barricade the shorelines, then you've lost the value of the beaches. So really difficult trade-offs and not something we can change quickly. Now, I said 10 myths about climate change, but I want to end on a somewhat more hopeful note. And that is, one of the myths is all hope is lost. I find several reasons for hope. I have solar panels on my roof, and I'm just astonished at how rapidly homegrown energy generation is happening. I was in Hawaii about a month ago, and it seemed that every home in Honolulu had solar panels now. I drove up here in an electric vehicle, a Tesla Model 3. My license plate is for climate. I want to thank the taxpayers of the United States for helping me buy this car with a federal tax credit. OSU is involved, along with several other universities, in testing wave energy off the coast of Newport, that lower diagram there. the potential to greatly expand the renewable energy generation from our from the water. And then on the right, these are sites where there's magma near enough to the surface of the Earth that we could drill a hole and put a geothermal power plant. It's a new generation, new type of geothermal power plant research project at Newberry Crater that led by AltaRock Incorporated up in Seattle. Great prospect for a steady type of renewable energy that wouldn't fluctuate. And finally, Greta Thunberg. I mean, the young people getting passionate about this and pushing for change gives me great hope. So I just want to end, you know, what if it's a hoax and we make a better world for nothing? Thank you. Yes. Yes.
So, you have time for questions?
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that talk. It was very clear. I learned a lot. I want to know, why don't acres of Walmarts and Costcos and roofs like that all over the country have solar panels on?
Some of those chain stores do. So if as you fly into PDX, you can see them on top of the IKEA. Walmart has been actually at the forefront of greening their stores, and so a lot of them do have solar panels. Sometimes it boils down to the local incentives. We're fortunate in Oregon that we had a state incentive. And so when I got my solar panels 2 years ago, roughly a third of the cost was paid by others. So I, you know, I paid two-thirds. Other states aren't quite as generous. And then you look at the electricity costs. So it's a longer payoff time here in the Northwest because at, you know, 10 to 12 cents a kilowatt hour, it takes longer for that savings to pay off. A more expensive state like Hawaii, you know, where they're more like 50 cents a kilowatt hour, it makes a lot of sense. So it's a combination of sort of corporate priorities and the economic value of the local situation. Yes.
I'm curious about the pH changes in water, and we hear a lot about the ocean pH becoming more acidic and the effect that's having on fisheries. And this area, being along the ocean coast as well as a big estuary here, it's a big impact economically for a lot of people. But I'm curious about what work's being done to see the effect on fresh waters, because the ocean, being so mineralized, it tends to buffer pH changes better than dilute waters such as lakes and rivers, which are common to all over the world on our continent. We depend on them. There's fisheries that live in those. The Andromeda's fish run off those. And this change in pH has got to be impacting those fresh waters a great deal. And yet, I don't hear that much talked about that aspect of it, nor do I hear it talked about just the fact that precipitation will become slightly more acidic and erode chemically, dissolve rocks more, and put more of those minerals into the streams and lakes. And what effects are those having? Are people looking at that?
Yeah, I have a diagram that I'd pull up if I had more time, but so the chemistry of fresh water is quite different, and you alluded to some of the processes, the erosion. So rainwater does leach carbon out of rocks, and that that enters the waterways. The natural pH of most fresh water is significantly more acidic than seawater. So seawater is something like 8. A lot of fresh water is more like 5. And six. So the acid rain problem in the 1970s, a lot of the concern was about places where the pH was as low as 4.5, and it was, you know, killing fish and pretty severe. And that's largely been alleviated, and so the natural pH is returning, you know, to more like 5.5 or 6. Several things are different. One is that the water cycles through much more quickly. So these processes of leaching chemicals out of the rocks, and then what the organic matter does, all influences those water bodies, and even on a very seasonal time scale. So it can go up and down from the spring snowmelt season through to the summer. Whereas in the ocean, you know, the entire ocean is absorbing CO2, and that's a much slower process. And some of the problems that we've had here on the coast have been really the interplay of the deep ocean water being brought up to the surface through our seasonal summer upwelling, and that tends to be low in dissolved oxygen, and then it meets the high CO2 water, and that has damaging interaction. So I'm not enough of a chemist to be able to give a better answer than that.
But I can tell you that most streams tend to be around pH 8. That's
really?
Very typical. Yeah. You go out with a pH meter and check a stream. I've done it for 30 years.
Okay. So I have some graphs from the EPA of the
lakes that are rivers with pHs of 6. They're 6. That's not typical.
Okay.
Carbonate buffer systems. Most of the surface water in the world is carbonate buffer, and it tends to be very close to 8, maybe high 7s in there. That's the range for, and so that's being affected by this acidic condition. I'm just curious about it.
Okay. Yes.
You didn't mention anything about the ozone layer, and I've always been somewhat confused about what that means or what. Is there actually a layer up there?
So between about 15 kilometers and about 50 kilometers, the concentration of ozone as a fraction of the number of molecules is much higher. So down in the troposphere, we typically only have elevated ozone it's considered air pollution, and it's produced largely by combustion. In the stratosphere, it's produced by absorbing ultraviolet radiation, which converts oxygen molecules into ozone molecules. And that process, then the ozone also absorbs ultraviolet light. So those concentrations are still quite low, but they're much higher than they are in the troposphere. So it's not a layer in the sense that you would be able to see it in any sense. I mean, that's a very broad band of elevated amounts. In the 1970s, it was theorized by two scientists who later won the Nobel Prize, Mario Molina and Sherwood Rowland, that chlorofluorocarbons would convey chlorine atoms into the stratosphere, and if there was a way to break them down, they could deplete the ozone layer. In 1985, British scientists discovered that there was a complete gap in ozone over Antarctica in the spring, which we now call the ozone hole. And a year later, Susan Solomon, scientist then at NOAA, went to Antarctica and figured out exactly what was happening, and it was that the sunlight was breaking down those chlorofluorocarbon molecules. And then there was additional chemistry happening on ice particles. So it was these unique conditions that allowed a catalytic reaction to completely destroy the ozone. The way that intersects, so that was sort of the first example of humans fundamentally changing the composition of the atmosphere by adding these inert gases, chlorofluorocarbons, which were used for aerosol spray cans and other things. We had affected the ozone layer. Now, in response to that Rowland and Molina paper, Oregon was one of the first two jurisdictions in the world to ban aerosol spray cans from using chlorofluorocarbons. So we actually got out in front of international policy on that topic. And then after the ozone hole was discovered, the world sort of got on board, and CFCs were eventually completely banned, and they're now illegal. It's amusing sometimes to see, I just found one a few weeks ago, a canister that says ozone safe. Well, guess what, folks? It's been illegal to emit ozone depleting substances since the 1990s. So it's, you know, you can brag about it, but it's sort of like saying, you know, no cocaine in this tap water. somebody over here had a, yes.
Yeah, if I may get back to solar panels, How does that work for people who are interested like myself?
Yeah, I would love to, and eventually will. But I view this as sort of the utilities problem to figure out. They are, you know, cooperating with state agencies and others to promote local generation. What other product can you sell back to the vendor at retail price? You know, imagine you walk out of a cupcake store with some cupcakes and you walk back in an hour later and say, I want to sell you your cupcakes back. It's a really wonderful thing. I know that the Northwest Power and Conservation Council for a long time has been, you know, looking forward and saying, how are we going to balance the growing production by renewables with the need for reliability? And, you know, there are a number of technologies, smart metering, encouraging people with electric vehicles only to charge at night, and, you know, setting up the technology so that the utility can actually do some of that demand management. Because their biggest challenge isn't the base load, or it isn't the fluctuations. It's when they get those peaks in demand, how do they match those?
They have to shut down the gorge wind turbines.
Yeah, that's happened a few times, right.
People cannot get into solar because they are generating, because we know we have enough energy from the sun in an hour, I think, to power every house in the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have so much energy.
There, yeah.
It's fabulous.
We need a 21st century energy grid, for sure. This is where some of the baseload solutions like the wave energy and geothermal can come in handy, because those are completely invariant. It doesn't matter what the wind and the sun is doing, they'll be producing. So yeah, and it's a big problem. Somebody's got to figure it out. But I think a homeowner who opts to put in the money to do that should be commended for doing that and being part of the generation side, and let the utility figure out though. My dad produces a lot more than he uses as well, and he's just fine with donating that to the world,
right,
for the good of the world.
It's for other reasons than just to make money,
right,
of course.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is definitely part of the solar energy, wind energy situation, is the grid that's kind of obsolete.
Yep. Yes, sir.
What political initiative would you like to see emerge in the next 2 years in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, both Washington and Oregon have, you know, made moves toward some kind of economy-wide carbon policy. The economists that I know say that if it's done right, it doesn't actually hurt the state's GDP. Now, it does hurt certain sectors, and, you know, so in Oregon we had the logging trucks circling the Capitol. Despite the best efforts of lawmakers to build in some buffers. I know that they're going to take another run at HB 2020 in the next legislative session. Maybe third time's the charm. Maybe it'll be the fourth or fifth time. The advantage of an economy-wide cap is that it provides a clear economic signal to reflect the actual cost to humanity of burning fossil fuels, and start to shift incentives toward other more efficient or more renewable sources of electricity. Washington is taking a somewhat different approach, but my view as a scientist is I want to see emissions reduced, because I understand the harm that will happen if we don't reduce emissions, and whatever policy gets us to reduce emissions is fine with me. If it's cap and trade, if it's a carbon tax, if it's just executive branch regulation, any means necessary. And, you know, I used to vote Republican back when Republicans stood for, you know, balanced budget and integrity and all those things. So I keep hoping that there will be some of those folks who step in to help solve this problem. And it looks like maybe Matt's trying to...
One more question.
Okay.
you think mass transportation is going to be a significant factor, improved mass transportation, in our emissions?
Well, you know, America is becoming more urbanized, and in most cities that means sprawl. And in other words, the growth in the footprint of cities is happening faster than the population growth. And so mass transit is the primary factor that, that alleviates that, that tendency. But there are very few cities that are set up to have mass transit actually expand as the population expands. There's a sort of minimum density needed to make mass transit effective. And as you go farther, farther out into sparsely populated suburbs, it becomes ineffective. So Oregon, with its progressive land use laws dating back to the 70s, the Portland metro area is one of the few in the continental US, well, a few in the US, that has a nearly one-to-one ratio of footprint to population. So unless the rest of the country, you know, think about places like Fresno and Boise, where they're sort of leapfrogging out. You know, you get the quarter acre lots and then the half acre lots, and you know, transit is just really ineffective in those.
I understand kind of the Canadians have done something pretty well with their urban planning.
I'll take your word for it.
Dr. Mote, this has been fascinating and a wonderful course on the state of the science. We as a small newspaper group have done one significant series on climate change, and we're about, I think, to embark on another, so I'd love to have your thoughts when you've had time to think about it, about what are the untold stories of climate change that deserve to be illuminated. It's, I know, a changing, fast-changing field, but I'd love to hear from you about that. Thank you all so much for attending. This is the start of a really interesting season, I think, for Columbia Forum. We'll be back on November 19th with Tom Hallman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning feature writer from the Oregonian that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. He writes wonderfully human oriented stories, and he'll have a number of them to share with us, and some maybe some tips about telling our own stories. So thank you all, and hope to see you in about 3 weeks.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Yeah, great audience.
Yeah,
it's fun.
Really engaged.
Fun group.
I'm glad the space worked out pretty well. I think people could basically see the screen all right.
Yeah.
So, I hope you enjoy the cannery here.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Good.
Thanks for inviting
Good.
Me.